The Sword of Fire, Book 1, Azulon, by William R. McGrath. Copyright 2007, William R. McGrath. Narration by James H. Brinkley. Chapter 3, Part 1. The Wolf and the Cobra. They sharpened their tongue as a serpent. Poison of an adder is under their lips. The Book of Psalms, 140, verse 3. In a large but otherwise unremarkable stone house in the oldest part of the city of Eberacium, a meeting is being held of the Builders' Guild. A short, pale man with hair like a poorly constructed bird's nest was speaking. He is Dew, head of the Government Teachers' Guild. Anyone reading the faces of those present would get the impression that Dew had been speaking for quite some time. Anyone, that is, but Dew himself.
"A war is coming, gentlemen. Between the old and the new, between the rough and orish shamans of the decaying religions of the world, and we, the truth-tellers, the philosophers, men of learning and of science. Know that we are engaged in a revolution, gentlemen, but not a tumultuous revolution of the sword and the catapult. No, 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 no. We fight a quiet revolution of the mind. Our battle will not be on the plains and in the valleys of Azulon, but in each and every school chamber in the land. The prize is the greatest of all, the future of humankind. For the battlefield is the very minds of our children. Are we to continue teaching our children mere facts, or shall we not strive for something higher, to teach our children how to think, and indeed how to act for the greater good? Who then shall decide what a child shall learn? Her father? Though he be an unschooled and illiterate farmer, or professional teachers like myself, who have studied long and hard, and whose very life's breath is education. I know what you in this room feel, and I am gratified."
Dew held up his hand as if to forestall applause. He eyed each man in the silent room with the self-satisfied air of those secure in their own righteousness, and then continued,
"How then shall we free our children from the rigid attitudes, narrow values and false beliefs taught by parents, blind to the new and better path we have chosen, and whose only hold over these children is the mere biological accident of their birth? My friends, I bring you the news that our first battle has already been won, and with barely a blow being struck. For our enemies did not deem the territory taken of any great value. That battle was for control of the schools that teach our future teachers the noble art of teaching. I am happy to report that these schools now view our curriculum with the same reverence that the most rabid followers of the old religions view their holy scriptures. The next battle will be a far greater struggle, though, for it must be waged in the schools that instruct our youth, which the enemy realizes is the true prize. I am confident we shall prevail, however, for this battle will be fought by the very teachers we have trained and who now see themselves as apostles of a new faith, a religion of humanity based on tolerance for all things and a love of self. A religion where every person is free to find his or her own way and own truth so that humankind can rise above the myths and legends of the old religions that have held us back for far too long."
Dew paused dramatically to take a slow, meaningful look around the room.
"But we have enemies, gentlemen, those who would try to hold back this new age of progress. Let me read to you what one senator has said of us."
He drew a small scroll from beneath his robes, unrolled it, and began to read aloud.
My countrymen, disguise the fact as we may, there is in this country today, and in both political parties, an element which is ripe for centralized despotism. There are men and houses of vast wealth, whose iron grasp spans this whole continent, and who find it more difficult and more expensive to corrupt the several freehold legislatures than one high senate. It was said of an Etruscan emperor of old that he wished the people of his land had but one head, so that he might cut it off with a single blow. And so it is with those moneyed kings who would rule this country through bribery, fraud, and intimidation. It's easy to see how, with all the powers of government centred in Eburasium, they could at a single stroke put an end to Azulonian liberty. But they well understand that before striking this blow, the minds of the people must be prepared to receive it. And what surer or safer preparation could possibly be made than is now being made, by indoctrinating the minds of the rising generation with the idea that ours is already a consolidated government, that the freeholds have no sovereignty which is not subordinate to the will and pleasure of the High Senate, and that our founding laws are the mere creatures of custom and may therefore be legally altered or abolished by custom. Such are a few of the poisonous doctrines which hundreds of thousands of Azulonian children are today drinking in with the very definitions of the words they are compelled to study. And yet, the man who dares to utter a word of warning of the approaching danger is stigmatized as an enemy to education and unfit to be mentioned as a candidate for the humblest office.
Dew looked around the room in triumph, for the truth of his case was so obvious to him that he knew none in the room could deny his cause.
"Gentlemen, you must agree with me that such men as these must be defeated. An election for the members of the High Senate approaches. Our candidates must be properly funded in order to vanquish the foes of progress. Our cause is just. Our people stand ready. The time for action is now."
"Thank you, friend Dew," said Sargon, leading the polite applause. It took a moment for Dew to realize that this was the signal for him to take his seat. Other men rose to speak, and various other matters were discussed. Finally, the general meeting came to an end.
"Surely you see the urgency in what must be done," said Dew to Sargon as he was guided towards the door.
"Yes. Yes, of course you are correct," replied Sargon. "I will speak to the Financial Committee about funding your candidates this very day." The great iron chambered door closed, echoing round the room. The members of the Financial Committee remained in the chamber. These men were the inner circle of the builders and its true leadership. A man with silver hair spoke.
"I think we should give Dew his gold, if for no other reason than to relieve us from the need to hear his twaddle again."
"If you think success will close that windy orifice he calls a mouth, then you do not know our friend Dew," said Sargon, and the men around him chuckled. "But we will fund his candidates nonetheless, because his enemies are our enemies."
They agreed then upon an amount. No scribe took down the vote, for no scribe was ever present at a Builders' Guild meeting. Later, Sargon would have a scribe write out a document authorizing the funds to be transferred from an account set up for such purposes. Sargon knew that the teachers in the government schools adamantly opposed anyone but they teaching Azulon's children, and this was what had brought Dew to the meeting today. These teachers spoke loudly of the children's good. But in truth, their furor was fueled by a fear of simple economic competition. In recent years, parents in Azulon had taken to pooling their money to fund small private schools, or to placing their children into schools run by houses of worship. Some even reverted back to a method successful for millennia, though mocked by the government teachers, parents teaching their own children in their own homes. The Builders' Guild opposed these alternative methods of education for a reason unrelated to the welfare of the government teachers. The builders saw these things for what they truly were, a source of intellectual competition, and that was something the men in the room could not allow if their plans for the future of Azulon were to succeed. do and his goals would be supported, for his enemies were indeed the enemies of the builders. A generation ago, the Guild began a program to wrestle the government schools away from the beliefs common to the people of Azulon, and turn them to a belief system more favorable to a world led by men such as they. To this end, they began with the schools that taught the teachers, conditioning them to think only in certain ways, and to believe only in certain things. The old ways of Azulon were mocked. Independence, faith, self-restraint, a common morality, all these were cast aside. Courses of study were watered down so that all could pass. Instead of creating independent thinkers, prepared to investigate the world around them, the government schools were turning out ignorant but happy sheep, who preferred a soft and pampered slavery to hard freedom and the responsibilities that freedom brought. Gradually, this thinking crept into the government schools at every level, and had now become the ruling orthodoxy among the teachers across the land. Many in Azulon opposed this, and a great divide was forming in the land, a divide of rich and poor, but not riches measured in gold, riches measured in education. The ironic thing, Sargon knew, was that none of the men in the room had sent their own children to a government school, though they advocated such education for others. No, their own children had private tutors, and were given curriculums not very different from those in the religious and private schools that they publicly opposed. Learning to be sheep was well and good for the masses, but their own children would learn to be leaders. A merchant across the table from Sargon was mimicking Du's whiny pleas to the amusement of the others. Sargon rapped his knuckles on the table.
"Now, let us move on to something of truly immediate concern," said Sargon. He looked gravely round the room, and the men became silent. "I have received a report from a fortune-teller in my employ."
"What? Are you listening to the spirits now, Sargon?" interrupted the head of another banking house, publicly a sharp competitor of Sargon, who thought of himself as rich enough and fat enough to make a jest at Sargon's expense.
"No, but many men, and in this case one woman, are foolish enough to speak things to those spirits that they would never tell to mortals," continued Sargon. "I keep many people in my employ who men will confide things to beyond anything they would tell a wife, brother, or priest. They are tavern owners, prostitutes, and yes, fortune tellers, who have their ears open for news and their hands open for my gold. One such fortune teller was visited recently by the wife of a certain senator close to Argius." At this news, even the rival banker leaned forward with interest. "This senator's wife came to my fortune-teller seeking counsel," continued Sargon. "It seemed that the Senate will vote today on a new law dealing with the minting of coins, and the senator's wife wished the spirits to tell her how she might profit from this proposed law."
"And why is this important?" asked the banker.
"It seems that Argius has been made aware of our plans concerning the freedom transfer boxes."
Sargon paused, so that his next statement would hit them all the harder. He would need them fully committed to accomplish the next step in his plan.
"And further, Argius has been shown the medallion."
A man across the table let out a curse. Another struck the tabletop with his fist.
Sargon held up his hands for silence. "And now Argius has proposed a law that will maintain the use of gold, silver, and copper as the only metals to be used as payment in Azulon, and therefore defeat our entire plan before it has even begun. The Senate votes on the law today. I have sent word to the few senators we still control, but I fear it is too late. I could do no more than state that we did not want the law passed. I could not tell them why, of course. If we had more warning of all of this, we could have mounted a campaign against the law. Convince the common people that the law would only benefit the rich and all the usual rubbish they are so willing to swallow. But, as things now stand, my belief is that this law of Argius's will pass."
"But how is this possible?" demanded the head of the largest shipbuilder in Azulon.
You assured us the medallions would not appear until we had regained control of the High Senate.
The powerful old men in the room grew angry, but under that anger there was fear. They were not young zealots willing to die for a higher cause. Their cause was their own wealth and power, and that cause might now be in jeopardy.
I have discovered the leak, said Sargon. He was a low-level clerk assisting in the counting of the medallions. While at this task, he managed to smuggle a defective medallion away that was due to be melted and remade.
The fat banker shifted his great bulk back into his chair.
So tell us, who was he working for, and has he been dealt with?
He was working for no one, as far as we could tell, replied Sargon. It seems the cause of his betrayal was that he found religion at some temple. The other clerks tell of him coming to work one morning, acting unusually cheerful and trying to convert them all to the worship of Yeshua. When I found that Argius had seen one of our medallions, I ordered an investigation, and this clerk was an obvious suspect. Under interrogation, he told all. It seems he believed that drivel about the trihex being an evil number, stole a medallion and turned it over to his local priest, who then apparently turned it over to that meddling cleric Simon. That is why religion is such a dangerous element in society. It makes men unpredictable and do things that defy all logic. The clerk is dead now, and for what? A number on a coin?
But does Argius actually believe that rot about the trihex?
Asked a man who made his wealth through theatres of the cheapest type.
I'd have thought an educated man such as he would not believe in those children's tales.
A tall, distinguished man rose to speak. He was a famous retired senator who had led a public crusade to raise taxes and soak the rich, as he put it. Though he himself had inherited great wealth, that none of the laws the senator ever proposed were written in a way that would touch his own fortune, but instead were designed to prevent the very people who voted for him from becoming wealthy themselves, was ever a source of amusement to him.
That the trihex can be read from any angle, and therefore easily readable on a coin or medallion, always escapes the notice of these religious fanatics, said the former senator. It is useful in a device like the transfer box, so that even should a medallion be put on the box in the wrong orientation, the box will still be able to read the central three numbers of the medallion.
This way, a merchant using the box won't think the box itself defective, and will know to simply turn the medallion around, rather than send the whole blasted box back to us.
Well said, sir. Well said, agreed Sargon.
Sargon knew why the man was so angered. When the medallion was first tried in Gaul 2 years ago, it did not yet bear the trihex, and the Gauls had experienced this very problem. The original prototype medallions contained 15 numbers, a three-digit country code, a three-digit code for the province or city of the user's birth, and the remaining 9 digits the identifying numbers for that person. Problems began to occur when the medallions were put on the black box the wrong way. The creators of the box suggested adding a 3-digit entry code as a prefix that could be read by the boxes whether right side up or upside down. That number turned out to be 666. If the central 3 digits were read as 999, the box would still recognize these as numbers and signal the merchant to turn the medallion around. The final medallions, and even the tattooed marks that would replace them, carried the 18-digit system. Sargon was satisfied in the direction the discussion was going so far.
But would they be willing to go the distance with him? What he was seeking had been done only once before in his lifetime.
It seems, continued Sargon, that Argius believes himself to be the moral pinnacle of Azulonian monarchy, and that any king who comes after him would misuse the power that the freedom transfer boxes would give the king.
But removing coinage from society would benefit every citizen in the realm,
protested the head of one of the three largest scribe services.
The day coins are outlawed and transfer boxes are the only means of buying or selling is the day that every black market in Azulon is destroyed. Theft will be a thing of the past. Only criminals need fear our system. Perhaps Argeus fears that one day things that are now legal would be made illegal, said Sargon, before someone else raised the point better.
Balderdash, replied the ex-senator. New laws that outlaw formerly legal things are being made every day, and you don't see the prisons overflowing with common citizens now, do you? No, the common man learns to conform to a new law like a horse to a new rider. There are no riots, no chaos, no revolution, because the people know that the majority of laws are, in the end, made for their benefit, and they abide by them. The few troublemakers there are soon found out and sent off to prison. The transfer boxes will simply mean that the foxes cannot stay underground for long. Do not forget, said an owner of a large western bank, how much of our houses would prosper with such a system. No more bits of parchment to be carried back and forth between merchant and banking house. No more fraudulent writs. No more, my boy will send round your payment in the morning. The savings to our houses on clerks alone will be monumental. We will be faster, more efficient, and much more profitable.
He addressed Sargon.
And now you tell us Argeus wants to stop this progressive move that will end so much crime in Azulon and profit us all.
Well done, thought Sargon. He does, and it goes beyond any prejudice to progress Argeus has shown in the past, said Sargon. If he succeeds, millions that should have been ours will be lost.
He fell silent, allowing that last sentence to sink into their minds and do its work.
That man is impossible to deal with, said the shipbuilder. This is not the first time his actions have cost us. Remember what he did to us with the Senate's terms? Only 2 terms per senator. Now many in the Senate think they no longer need our gold or our counsel. Half the old Senate gone. And what did those young fools do once they came to power? Pass that foolish sales tax law, undoing all we have worked so hard on these many years.
The new tax system was simple, direct, and fair, and thus hated by many who had used the old system to gain and retain power. Men, including many in that room, who had never paid any great amount in taxes before, now had to pay the same percentage as every other person in Azulon, and that rankled them to no end. Politicians, from senators to local magistrates, who had previously made millions by changing the tax laws to favour one group or another for a time, and then made millions more to change the laws back again, now had no say in how the taxes were collected, and now had one less thing to hold their hands out for, and thus be beholden to the powerful men in this room for. Argeus, in their eyes, was the ultimate author of this tax law. For it was he who had made it possible for these new senators to be elected, and thus pass the law. And that was a wound that they would never forgive. Sargon looked around the room as he saw that the men there were almost visibly shaking with rage. In his mind's eye he saw them as a pack of caged wolves, snarling and snapping, fangs dripping with hatred, eager for the cage door to fly open so that they could tear their prey apart.
Argeus is the wrong king for this time, said the fat banker. Argeus is a senile old fool and should not be king at any time, called out another man, giving voice to what they had all been thinking. Argeus's son is not yet of age to become king, said Sargon. And Argeus himself will not step down until the prince returns from his training in Logres 10 years from now. If Argeus's term were to end prematurely, for whatever reason, Aram, his prime minister, would be made Stuart king until the prince's return.
He looked around the room.
I have it on good authority that Aram would be far more reasonable in regards to our plans than Argeus. Remember, gentlemen, a Stuart king may propose a law as easily as any king.
He paused for a moment, then, giving each word careful emphasis, he said,
Just as men are not immortal, neither are their laws. What one man has brought to life, another man may kill.
The room grew deathly silent as each man weighed the risks of what hung unsaid in the chamber. Then the cold, hard men in the room looked into the cold, hard eyes of their neighbour and found agreement.
Are we of one mind, then? This is a problem that should be dealt with expeditiously?
Asked Sargon.
Yes, said the southerner. Aye, let it be as you say, said another.
One by one they gave their consent.
I will see what can be done, said Sargon, smiling within himself.
Azulon by William R. McGrath. Copyright 2007, William R. McGrath. Narration by James H. Brinkley. For more information on this book series, please go to www.theswordoffire.com.